From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on tensions in Ukraine, the search for the missing Malaysian passenger plane, armed youths attacking a UN compound in South Sudan, plus helping adults with autism have productive lives. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Top diplomats from Ukraine, Russia, the European Union, and the United States have agreed on a set of measures to ease mounting tensions in eastern Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke after the Thursday meeting in Geneva.
The parties agreed today that all sides must refrain from the use of violence, intimidation, or provocative actions. And we strongly condemned and rejected all expressions of extremism, racism, and religious intolerance, including anti-Semitism.
The seven-paragraph agreement does not specifically require Moscow to withdraw 40,000 troops massed on its border with Ukraine and does not reference Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula last month. It also does not obligate Moscow to hold direct talks with the interim government in Kiev. And in Moscow on Thursday, President Vladimir Putin said he has a right to send troops into Ukraine, but hopes he will not have to exercise that right. Speaking live on a Russian TV call-in show after a clash in eastern Ukraine in which three pro-Russian protesters were reported killed, Mr. Putin warned the Ukrainian authorities of the abyss they're heading into and urged dialogue. He also admitted for the first time that Russian forces had been active in Crimea, which was annexed by Moscow last month. Previously, he insisted that the camouflage masked gunmen who took over Crimea were a local self-defense force. But Mr. Putin stopped short of saying Russian forces were currently operating in eastern Ukraine. He harshly criticized the West for trying to get Ukraine to align with and said that the people in eastern Ukraine have risen against the authorities in Kiev who ignored their rights and legitimate demands. He also said he will not recognize the results of Ukraine's upcoming elections on May 25th. And while diplomats met in Geneva on Thursday and President Putin spoke in Moscow, the U.S. defense chief announced the United States will provide more non-lethal assistance to Kiev. The action signals support for the country in its standoff with Russia, but falls short of adding U.S. weaponry. VOA's Jeff Seldon reports the defense chief also pledged support for NATO.
U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says this is a critical time for NATO, expressing concerns about what he calls Russia's ongoing destabilizing activities in eastern Ukraine.
The actions of the Russians over the last 2 months is not only irresponsible and violates territorial integrity and sovereignty of a sovereign nation, but it's dangerously irresponsible.
Following a meeting with the Polish defense minister at the Pentagon, Hagel said Russia's aggression has renewed U.S. resolve to strengthen NATO and that U.S. military planners are working to help update the alliance's defense plans. Hagel says the U.S. is also looking at other ways to reassure allies in Central and Eastern Europe.
These measures are not meant to provoke or threaten Russia, but instead to demonstrate NATO's continued dedication to collective defense.
Already, the U.S. has sent 12 additional F-16 fighter jets to bolster a detachment in Poland. Those jets will now likely stay through the end of the year. And Hagel announced the U.S. will provide Ukraine with more non-lethal military assistance, including medical supplies, helmets, sleeping mats, and water purification units. Despite requests for military assistance, the Obama administration has until now provided Ukraine mostly with financial support while pressuring Russia diplomatically. Meanwhile, NATO is also strengthening its presence in the region, saying Thursday it will send a contingent of mine-hunting ships to the Black Sea. Poland, a NATO member, is also worried about Russia and has been in talks with the U.S. about modernizing its military. Polish Defense Minister Tomasz Simoniak said through an interpreter, he's encouraged by what he's heard.
We want Poland to be as close to the West as possible, cooperating with NATO and with the United States, and there is no other way for us to guarantee our own security.
Despite expressing hope talks will help defuse growing tensions, Defense Secretary Hagel refused to rule out the possibility Russia could be looking to reclaim territory and influence lost in the collapse of the old Soviet Union, saying, based on past actions, we have to look at every possibility. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Also in the news, South Korean rescuers fought strong currents as well as murky waters in their search for more than 250 people missing from a capsized ferry off the country's southern coast. Coast Guard officials are confirming numerous deaths and expect those numbers to rise sharply. More than 170 passengers have been rescued so far. Among the ferry's 475 passengers were 325 students from a high school near Seoul traveling to a popular resort island for a four-day field trip and sightseeing. Authorities have not established the cause of the disaster. The U.S. Navy deep-sea submarine known as the Bluefin has completed its first full scan of the seabed in the remote Indian Ocean. The team looking for the missing Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777 that disappeared last month. On Thursday, search aircraft returned to their base in Perth, Australia, without reporting any new leads on where the plane might be. Still, aviation expert Jeffrey Thomas of AirlineRatings.com says it's too early to lose patience.
I think it's very important that we focus on what Air Chief Marshal Angus Houston said a couple of days ago, and that is this search could take between a couple of weeks and up to 2 months using the Bluefin 21. And we should also remember that it took us 2 years to find Air France 447. This is going to be, or could be, a long and painful process.
Thomas also spoke about what happens if the search of the seabed turns up nothing.
If the Bluefin 21 fails after several months of searching to find anything at all, then obviously we have to recalculate, rethink exactly what might have happened to this aeroplane, but all the evidence supports the fact that they are looking in the right place.
Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on March 8th with 239 people aboard.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA. Every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Officials in South Sudan say armed youths attacked people taking refuge in a United Nations compound happened in the capital of Jonglei State. VOA's Gabe Joslow reporting that the fighting in the nation threatens the most vulnerable populations.
A spokesman for South Sudan's opposition forces, James Gatet Dak, says the youths overran the UN compound in Bor on Thursday and began indiscriminately shooting at civilians inside.
This is very unfortunate. And these are mainly women and children, innocent women and children. We condemn in the strongest terms possible this barbaric attack and massacre of the unarmed, innocent civilians.
The number of those killed or wounded is unclear. On Twitter, UN humanitarian chief for South Sudan, Toby Lanzer, said he is outraged by the attack. Tens of thousands of civilians have been sheltering at UN bases across the country since fighting broke out in December following a rift between President Salva Kiir and his former vice president Riek Machar. The government's military spokesman, Colonel Philip Aguirre, says he heard reports of Thursday's attack but did not know any details, calling it a very unfortunate and unacceptable incident that needs to be investigated. Aguirre also says government forces, known as the SPLA, are moving toward the key oil town of Bentiu, which rebels seized on Tuesday.
Forces of the SPLA are encroaching into Bentiu town, and any time the rebel will be out of the town.
Aguirre accused Sudanese militia, including the Khartoum-backed Janjaweed, of supporting the rebels who took Bentiu, which is close to the border with Sudan. Bentiu is the capital of Unity State, a major oil-producing region, although production has been stopped there for several months. Anti-government forces have threatened to take control of the remaining oil fields in the country and have ordered companies to stop production and evacuate staff. The UN says more than 800,000 people have been internally displaced by violence in South Sudan, and warns that the upcoming rainy season will put more people at risk of food insecurity. On Wednesday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said without immediate intervention, up to 1 million people could face famine in a matter of months. Gabe Joselow, VOA News, Nairobi.
And as South Africa's powerful ruling party hits 20 years in power, it's losing loyalists, including big-name supporters who helped the party back when it was banned and seeking to overthrow the oppression of apartheid. The growing group of defectors says it is tired of the corruption in the African National Congress, and it thinks that more should be done to improve the lives of South Africans. VOA's Anita Powell hears from some of the discontents.
Justice Makakula knows that the African National Congress is the party that won him the freedom he enjoys in today's South Africa. He was born just before the death of the racist apartheid system and says he remembers well the awful treatment that he endured as a young black South African, and then, on that historic election day in 1994, how everything changed. But in the last 20 years, persistent inequality, widespread complaints about the ANC-led government's failures to provide basic services, and a series of embarrassing scandals around President Jacob Zuma have led many South Africans to disavow the party they fought for during the nation's darkest days. A new campaign headed by former ANC stalwarts is calling on citizens to vote against the party in May, or to intentionally spoil their ballots to show their dissatisfaction. Makakula is part of this growing demographic, the disgusted voter. Except, he says, he plans to skip the polls entirely.
I'm not going to vote, to be honest with you. I'm not going to vote. I'm just going to go on with my life because my life is more important than everything I got. For this thing of voting, man.
He is not alone, says journalist and analyst Khadija Patel, who runs a website called SA Votes, which tracks trends around this election and has surveyed tens of thousands of voters.
We're hearing a lot of South Africans telling us that instead of changing, especially ANC voters, voters who have previously voted for the ANC, we're hearing from them that they're not voting at all in this election because they don't see their vote to have made any difference. They can't see any tangible difference made in their lives, so they find the whole exercise of voting rather futile.
Patel also says she has picked up on another related trend.
What is interesting here is that instead of going or shipping over their vote to any of the opposition parties, instead they are choosing not to vote at all, which, I mean, a lot could be said here then of the weakness of the opposition in South Africa. But certainly I think this also speaks to, somewhat of a growing disenchantment with the ANC and indeed with the political process in South Africa.
Makakula again illustrates this trend perfectly. At 26 years old and without steady employment, he is in the crosshairs of a rising political party that was formed out of disgust for the ANC, the far-left Economic Freedom Fighters. But Makakula says he has little faith in that party's key figure, expelled ANC youth leader Julius Malema.
I'm going to vote Malema, and after that, what Malema's going to do? He's going to betray every one of us, you know? So, like, what I'm going to do, I'm just going to keep on, like, shut up. Not vote for everyone, just go for my life.
Gardener Jeremiah Paketti says he was a supporter of the ANC before. But this time around, he says the scandals around Mr. Zuma, including spending $23 million of taxpayer money on upgrades to one of his personal homes, have left him uncertain.
I can't think about the ruling party just now, because I think all the parties have got corruption. Maybe I can vote for another party. Yes, because I'm looking first for the other president, not Zuma.
No one expects the ANC to do anything as drastic as lose at the polls. The party has won a consistent majority since its debut election in 1994 under Nelson Mandela. The ANC maintained that level, never going over 70%, in subsequent elections. But some critics say the end is near. Helen Zille is the leader of the nation's top opposition party, the Democratic Alliance. She says the ANC is overburdened with scandal and that this election will be the start of its downward slide.
The realignment of politics is going to involve the disintegration of the ANC as we currently know it and the reconstitution of a new majority at the non-racial center of South African politics. And if that happens by 2019, we will have saved our constitution and our democracy, and be on a very good platform to grow our economy and to create jobs and to include everybody in a meaningful economy for the future.
The Nation votes May 7th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Algerians went to the polls to decide who will govern the country for the next 5 years, ailing President Abdelaziz Bouteflika seeking a fourth term. He faces strong opposition from a former prime minister, and Edward Uranian has our report.
77-year-old President Abdelaziz Bouteflika cast his vote from a wheelchair as journalists and well-wishers looked on. The president smiled but said little, clutching the hand of a young nephew who walked alongside him. A group of women ululated to salute him as the president greeted his supporters outside the polling station. Mr. Bouteflika, who suffered a stroke last year, appeared alert but weak. Interior Minister Tayyip Belaziz read out voter participation figures from various cities. He stresses that voting is taking place without any major glitches at 50,000 polling stations across the country. There were a few media reports of protests and clashes around the country, but there did not appear to be significant violence. The leading opposition candidate, Ali Benflis, spoke with journalists after voting. The former prime minister says he hopes to rejuvenate the country if he is elected, but warns there could be trouble if there is cheating during the vote count. He adds, however, that he opposes any violence. State television announcers report that voter turnout was heavy, although video from relatively empty polling stations seemed to contradict them. Interior Minister Belaziz notes that by mid-morning, about 9% of the country's 20 million eligible voters had been to the polls. One elderly lady shouts, "Long live Algeria," as she votes, going on to express her optimism. A young man with his daughter says he is voting for the future of Algeria and that he hopes the election will help the people. Six candidates, including former Prime Minister Ali Benflis, are competing to be the country's president for the next 5 years. Incumbent President Bouteflika has held the office since 1999. He was Algeria's youngest foreign minister and is the last of a generation of leaders who came to power after independence from France in 1962. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Many parents of children with disabilities fear for the future of their adult child. It can be difficult for them to find work or live on their own. Oftentimes, help comes from the community of families affected by the same condition. The mother of an autistic boy set up a foundation to advocate for estimated 1.2 million American adults with autism, a developmental disorder that causes communication difficulties and often social awkwardness. More now from VOA's Faith Lapidus.
Rafael Angevine can spend hours taking photographs.
I just do it for myself. I don't try to set up a scene or anything. I just take pictures.
Rafael was diagnosed with autism 3 years ago when he was 26. His father and mother, Noeli, encouraged their son to pursue his passion for photography.
His photographs, the way he sees the found object, the ordinary object, and picks up what's beautiful about man-made things as well as what's in nature, to me, is almost mystical.
When Raphael's therapist told Noalie about an art exhibit by autistic artists, she wanted her son to participate. The exhibit, called Through Our Eyes, is sponsored by the Madison House Autism Foundation, a nonprofit that advocates for autistic adults. Co-founder Jalen Price named it after her 24-year-old autistic son, Madison.
The most daunting concern is, when I'm not around any longer, who is going to make certain that my son has a happy and productive life?
The foundation lobbies for legislation to enhance opportunities and reduce barriers to meeting the housing and employment needs of adults with autism.
Employment is huge because it's estimated about 85% of those on the spectrum may never have totally gainful employment.
Sponsoring the exhibit advances another goal of the foundation, promoting understanding and inclusion in the community.
We don't have enough physicians that know anything about adults on the spectrum to be able to treat these adults. We have safety issues in the community. Some of our population tend to wander. And what happens if they encounter a police officer and a police officer asks somebody to stop? And they're not going to stop because they don't know the police officer. And it can escalate before someone even understands that someone may be on the spectrum. They may feel that they're on drugs or something else.
The art exhibit includes the work of more than 20 artists and is presented in collaboration with the universities at Shady Grove in Maryland. The school's executive director, Stuart Edelstein, says it is a great learning opportunity for his students.
We are in the process of educating students who will become nurses, teachers, social workers, and general citizens in our community. And for them to understand in a more deep way the needs of a segment of our community, people with autism, is really important in terms of their professional development.
Noalie Angevine, Raphael's mother, agrees that events like this benefit people like her son and society at large.
The economy would profit by using the talents of people like Raphael instead of letting them end up on the street.
It gives her hope that her son will continue to have a good life when she's no longer around. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Hi, I'm David Byrne.
And I'm Lin Yang.
I'm Aisha Holly.
And I'm Madeline Eck.
We're the hosts of VOA's Now.
We'll be bringing you stories that interest you.
Join the conversation
every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday,
beginning April 28th for the Voice of America's Now.
Ford Motor Company is celebrating the 50th anniversary of its iconic Mustang sports car by staging a recreation of the model's famous debut. U.S. automaker displayed a special edition of its 2015 Mustang convertible this week on the observation deck of the Empire State Building, 86 floors above the New York City skyline, exactly where the original version was unveiled during the 1964 World's Fair. George Simulski, an executive with Ford's design section, says technicians face some special challenges in getting the car up to the top of the landmark building.
We had to bring it up to the elevators, and the problem that we ran into was that the elevators are very small here. They were built back in the 30s, and the dimension of the width of the elevator door is only 36 inches, and it's only 56 inches deep. So we had to, we actually built an elevator back in Dearborn to simulate the size that we have to cut the car into to get it up to the 86 observation deck.
You really should go online and get some views of what they had to do to get that car up there. Nearly 500,000 Mustangs were sold the first year that it was produced, back in 1964. Ford Mustang is the first and only automobile to be displayed on the top of the Empire State Building. Ford only plans to build 1,964 of the special edition 2015 Mustangs. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, you can find us on the Internet anytime at voanews.com. And I hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Keith Holmes, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On April 18, 1506, the cornerstone of the current St. Peter's Basilica was laid in Rome. The building replaced an old church from the 4th century. Construction of the newer building was completed in 1626. The huge structure is one of the largest churches in the world and is regarded as one of the holiest sites in the Roman Catholic Church. On this day in 1775, British General Thomas Gage dispatched a force of 700 troops from Boston to destroy a colonial weapons cache in the nearby town of Concord. Spies quickly learned of the plan, and several horsemen, including Paul Revere and William Dawes, rode toward Concord to warn that the British were coming. At dawn, a British advance guard was met at Lexington by colonial militiamen determined to stop them. Gunfire erupted in what is considered the first shots fired in the American Revolutionary War. Exactly 8 years later, in 1783, fighting in the war came to an end following the defeat of British forces near Yorktown, Virginia. On this day in 1906, an earthquake struck San Francisco, California. Thousands of buildings collapsed. Authorities estimate the quake and resulting fires killed at least 3,000 people. On this day in 1923, baseball's famed Yankee Stadium opened for its inaugural baseball game, New York versus Boston. In 1946, the International Court of Justice held its first meeting in The Hague, Netherlands. The court was founded to prosecute people charged with genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. In 1954, Gamal Abdel Nasser took power in Egypt. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Health officials in West Africa are struggling to contain an outbreak of Ebola hemorrhagic fever, a deadly contagion that has claimed more than 100 lives. The first cases were reported last month in Guinea, and now also are being seen in neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone. While working to respond to the crisis, the World Health Organization has not recommended any trade or travel restrictions in the region. Nevertheless, as a sign of its concern, Senegal has closed the land border it shares with Guinea as a preventive measure. Given the deadly nature of the disease, such concern is justified. Ebola is highly infectious and has no cure. A particularly virulent virus, Ebola is believed to originate in an infected animal and is spread to humans by diet or contact with bodily fluids. Its early symptoms include fever and weakness, then deepens with bouts of diarrhea, vomiting, and internal bleeding. There have been previous outbreaks of the disease in the forests of Central Africa, but this is the first incidence of it reported in the West African nations now contending with it. They are not acting alone, though. The United States and other partners are working with international health officials to aid the fight. A five-member team from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Viral Special Pathogens Branch flew to Guinea on March 31st to provide expert advice and consultation. In addition, a small team of CDC experts will travel to Liberia to provide technical assistance to the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare. The U.S. Agency for International Development is funding a mobile laboratory in Guinea that can quickly do tests in suspected cases of the disease. Under another USAID grant, protective equipment is being provided to healthcare workers treating the sick. The U.S. Defense Department is working with Metavioba, Inc., a company that monitors viral disease threats around the world, to provide assistance for lab testing of samples from suspect cases. Our diplomatic missions in the capitals of the affected nations, as well as others, are monitoring the situation there closely. And USAID has provided $583,500 through UNICEF's Regional Rapid Response Fund to provide households and clinics in Guinea with supplies and equipment, as well as fund a public information campaign to help people protect themselves from infection. Finally, we extend our sympathies to the families and loved ones of those who have died. And for those fighting the disease, know that our hearts and prayers are with you.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.